Hello, Lopez. I'm Lorna Reese, host of Lopez Writers Read. If you've ever attended one of our Writers Read evenings at Lopez Center, you might be familiar with what we do on this show. We bring you your friends and neighbors reading from their own writing work. In our program, we talk with featured writers about their work and their process, and they read a couple of pieces to us as well. This show is being pre-recorded in October 2009. I have a squeaky chair, so put up with that, Lopez. My guest today is Stephen Adams. One of Steve's stories was published in the fall issue of Shark Reef. So just let me read to you from his bio on the website. Stephen Adams, who finds it disconcerting to speak of himself in the third person, has written stories, novels, newspaper articles, instructional manuals, promotional newsletters and copy, and grocery lists. He generally finds the latter to be his most useful work, but writes fiction because it's the only way to remove the voices crowding his head from his already addled brain pan. So that, Steve, leads us to our first question. Where does your fiction originate? Do you really have characters inhabiting your head?
My fiction largely originates from my fiction largely originates from a voice, a line, an episode, a what if situation, and it's a way of exploring, you know, that particular voice, that particular character's quirk, the speculative nature of the what if question. So,
can you give us an example of a what if?
Well, I'm actually going to read at some point today a brief excerpt from the beginning of a story I wrote called Uncle Zubies. I had gone into a fast food restaurant with my cousin to get a cup of coffee, and it had an amusement area for children, and in it had one of those swimming pool sized places that are filled with little plastic balls.
Yes, yes.
And I saw a child getting in there, and I thought, what would happen if a child got in there and just disappeared off the face of the planet? And and that sort of hung with me for a while until one day I wrote the story, of which I'm very fond, although nobody I've sent it to is very fond. But so that's an example of it.
Okay. Well, how about, I want to know a little bit about your development as a writer. When did you start writing fiction? I mean, did you start writing fiction, or what did you start writing? How did you get to be where you are today, writing mostly fiction along with the grocery lists and the articles in the weekly that I've seen about artists, which are wonderful?
Thank you
for bringing the artists to us in that way.
I thank Helen Sanders for giving me the opportunity to do that, and the wonderful artists who've given me their time. I would say that, like most writers I know, I came to writing by virtue of the fact that I love to read, and it was a remarkable thing to me when I started realizing that somebody actually wrote these stories that I love to read. Growing up in the South, and while we don't have exclusive rights to this particular thing, I do think it is a characteristic of our region. Growing up in the South, I grew up with a family of storytellers and surrounded by storytellers, and so the fiction sort of came naturally, because no matter how rooted in veracity the story itself is, inevitably the storyteller would alter it for his or her own purposes of, usually of just telling a good story.
Yeah, to make it a little better or more interesting,
absolutely,
or exciting or something.
I have found notebooks that I was writing when I was 6 or 7 years old that had stories in them. So I guess I've been writing fiction, and they were stories. They were made up stories. I guess I've been writing fiction since I'm 54 now, for almost 5 decades.
Right. And did you study it in school then, when you went to college? Did you study
creative writing?
You know
what? I don't know that I ever actually took a writing course. A creative writing course. Obviously, I was an English teacher for a number of years, so obviously I took the requisite composition courses. But I don't know that I ever actually formally studied, the craft of writing, mm-hmm. Other than by reading really good stuff and by, having the great fortune of getting to know a number of really good writers.
Mm-hmm. How about by teaching it, too? Teaching in the high school, I would imagine that, to teach it, you have to know how to write.
Yeah, I really think that I'm probably a better teacher of the art of writing fiction than I am a writer, because I really mean that. I'm not trying to be immodest or modest with that statement. I so admire the craft of writing that I have studied it a lot, and I love to impart that to others. So, the old truism that if you really want to learn something well, you teach it. I think it is a truism for a reason.
So as a writer then, have you taken stories that you particularly enjoyed and sort of analyzed them, taken them apart? I mean, have you done that process, which I'm only now learning to do myself?
I actually have done that with a few stories, and I have been doing that extensively with the novel from which I'm going to read an excerpt today. It's usually a very, I want to say, humbling experience.
Yeah,
it
sure.
Normally makes me want to, go throw myself off a rock or something.
Yeah.
Because I have been fortunate to read really good writers, and
mm-hmm.
I know that while I have moments as a good storyteller, I am not a really good writer. I'm not, so my stories don't bear much scrutiny beyond that should be afforded a story.
Mm. Lately, I've started wondering about whether, I think for some people, I wonder if writing is instinctive, that they just sort of know somehow. But they don't have to stop and think about the arc of a story. They don't have to think of whether there's conflict or tension. They just somehow instinctively know that. And
I completely agree with you. I mean, obviously, people who write and write a lot get better at it, just somebody who plays
tennis,
the piano or
yeah.
tennis
yeah.
gets better at it.
Yeah.
But I do think that there are... I truly do. I don't think you ever have to have sat down and followed the diagram of rising action and all those other and climax and things like that to know this. I think that there are people who, and I think by and large, the creative process, when it is really clicking, is instinctive. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be informed by studying
No.
the creative process of others. I think it should be, and I think it is improved by that. But I do think the creative process is largely instinctive.
I would agree with that. Tell me a little bit more about the writers whose work you particularly have enjoyed reading and how that maybe has contributed to the kind of writing you do, or...
That was one of the one of the sample questions you had sent me that I was looking at this morning, and I was thinking about it. I sometimes glibly give the answer, but it's also, I think, an accurate answer that whatever good writer I happen to be reading today is my favorite writer.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I certainly, having grown up, again, you know, the regionalism, certainly having grown up in the South with people like William Faulkner and Thomas Wolfe and Flannery O'Connor and, God bless her, Eudora Welty. I have to say her name again, Eudora Welty. And people like that, you know, I was very fortunate in that regard, because even people who I did not think of as readers, such as my father, read people like Faulkner. I mean, my dad was from Mississippi. Faulkner was from Mississippi,
right.
So he read him, and
really?
And I would certainly say the King James Version of the Bible. Nothing will give one a sense of cadence and language, with the possible exception of someone like Shakespeare, like the King James Version of the Bible. I really believe that. Thomas Wolfe once called the Book of Ecclesiastes in the King James Version the best thing ever written in the English language. And
I'm going to have to go and read that.
It's pretty fine, I'll tell you. there are so many good contemporary writers, and not just fiction. That's who I've been talking about. But, I mean, you know, I was introduced to Eugene O'Neill at an early age. I started reading Emily Dickinson when I was a kid, and even though I didn't get her, I just loved what she was doing. And when I did get her, it was like somebody had knocked five or six holes through five or six walls, and I was at a place that I couldn't imagine ever being. I don't know. I could go on with that list for the remainder of our time.
You know? Maybe after the interview is over, we can talk about our top 10 books, because I've started a list. I'll just tell you one of them, Paul Scott, who wrote The Raj Quartet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've never read that, but I've heard of it.
It's such masterful language. There's four big, fat books, mm-hmm. and they comprise one of the spots on my top 10 list. But if you haven't read those yet, you have a treat. He uses long sentences that you get lost in. I mean, you don't get lost in them, but they're so beautiful. They're so beautifully constructed, and they take you to a place that is very deep and profound and far away. So it's a very different kind of writing, and you have to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I was... The genre that I was raised really enjoying was the genre of mysteries, and I was very fortunate to run across people like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and people like that. Now there's a whole school of really some fine writers. I think of George Pelecanos, who is an excellent writer, and I think of him more in terms of writing social fiction, like Steinbeck did, more than, say, a crime novel. There are so many good ones out there.
Okay. Well, why don't you read something to us now?
Okay, I'm gonna move away from the mic here a moment.
Okay, and be sure to set the scene for us, and let us be with you from the very starting moment.
Okay, this is from a novel I wrote, the second novel I ever wrote. The first one I wrote simply because I wanted to write a novel, and I've never looked at it since, I can truthfully tell you, because I'm sure it's pretty awful. But it taught me that I could write a novel, and that was very important. This is from a novel called Yenestra. The title is, well, there's just a long story behind the title, but it's from a novel called Yenestra, Y-N-E-S-T-R-A. This occurs midway through the novel. The novel is told in first person, and it takes place in Pensacola, Florida, a small town in northwest Florida where I grew up, and has some autobiographical elements, but I don't think of it as being autobiographical. The character is in trouble with the law due to his drinking, and is about to go have a meeting with the social worker who is supposed to be assisting him through this particular portion of the legal process. And I've not read this out loud more than once, and that was about 25 minutes ago.
It'll be familiar.
It's a good way. I think that just comes from you know, my grandmother used to apologize for her biscuits, which were the world's best. You know, these biscuits might kill you, son. Okay, so anyway, this is from midway through a novel called Yonestra. The next morning, I showered, dressed, had the single can of beer I allotted myself, and then pedaled my unsteady bicycle into downtown Pensacola for my appointment with the authority on substance abuse, who was going to try and plumb the well of my ill and bankrupt life. The first thing I saw when I walked through the dingily curtained glass doors of the Escambia County Recovery Center was the short, square, glowering wall that was the woman I knew as Nurse Delcy Mentone. She was standing solidly behind a deeply scored pressboard desk and monotonously punishing a pencil sharpener. Breathing through my nose, I approached her and said, "Excuse me, my name's Paul. Fill this out," she said, thrusting a paper-covered clipboard across at me. "Pencil's here. Don't try and keep it. When you get through, we'll get a urine sample." "What?" I shook my head and scuffled to the opposite wall in a line of hard plastic chairs, taking a seat under a dull, time-faded poster that admonished me to respond to any drug-related opportunities that might come my way with the merest negative imperative. The questions clipped before me were all ones I had seen and answered on innumerable previous occasions, and I scrawled with hurried abandon, eager to skip through my designated hoops for the day and get back for my increasingly necessary mid-morning beer. I put the more or less complete paperwork back on her desk and found myself locked into a staring contest with her. Other than the absence of the nursing cap atop her rigid and manufactured hair, she looked exactly as she had that night years ago in the drunk ward at Baptist Hospital when I'd first encountered her. If anything, her face was even more deeply rucked with furious malice. Finally, I said, "Look, I'm Paul Davis, and I have an appointment this morning with somebody here named Tony Arno. So I was just letting you know, that's all." "Well, Mr. Paul Davis, it just so happens that I can read, okay? And I see your name right here at the top of the paperwork I just had you fill out." She reached in her top desk drawer and produced a small plastic bag containing a clear fat cylinder with the screw-on black top. She tossed it at me, not bothering to see if I caught it, which I did, but just barely. "Go in the bathroom over yonder. There's a pen on top of the little shelf over the sink. Use it to write your name on the yellow label inside and stick it on the bottle, and then fill it up to the red line with the urine sample. Then put everything back in the bag and drop it through the slot in the wall over the toilet." I nodded and started walking off. "And Mr. Paul Davis, before you do any of that, give me my pencil back." I dropped it on her desk without a word. I went in, shut the door, and filled the bottle with tap water from the sink, then dropped the whole package through the slot and returned to her desk. "Well, that didn't take you very long," she said. "No, ma'am. I practiced taking a leak before I got here this morning." Her eyes were small as thimbles and hard-looking as worn knobs. "You look mighty familiar to me, but then, sooner or later, I've seen every one of you. Most of you a lot more times than I'd care to. But that don't matter. You just watch your mouth with me, you know what's good for you. Now, go have a seat. Tony will be here with you directly." I resumed my seat and slouched down, listening to the wino a couple of chairs away from me muttering, It's serious, I'm telling you. Serious. Cryptically, over and over, to himself or to nobody at all. I heard a door down the hallway open, and then a woman walked out and over to the desk where she took a handful of papers, smiled into Delcy Mentone's depthless scowl, and then came and stood before me. "Paul Davis," she said, extending her long, slender hand. "I'm Tony Arno." I followed her to the back. She was a couple of inches taller than I and a few years younger, about Tina's age. She had a narrow, pretty face set incongruously under a layered and feathered coiffure that looked as if it were cut and pasted from a pert suburban mom in a mid-70s sitcom. We sat in her small office, half filled with the disheveled desk covered with tottering stacks of manila folders and loose typed sheets, and she reviewed my paperwork. "Listen," I said, "before you and I get started, may I ask you something?" "Sure." "Do you know that you have a psychopath working admissions out there for you?" "Oh," she said. She put the papers down and squared her small shoulders. "Did Nurse Mentone object to your aftershave?" I smiled. I was thoroughly caught. I began to relax and breathe normally through my mouth. Nurse Mentone seems to object to anything even remotely human. She and I have crossed paths one other time, and, despite my pronounced and dire medical needs, the best she could do was threaten to crack my skull. "Look, Paul, working here is not what most people consider to be a real plum assignment. But most of us are here because we think we can occasionally do some good, that our jobs can make a difference. Every now and then, somebody seeks out a place like this because they've got an axe to grind." "With me?" I said. "With anyone who's got a problem like what you've probably got. See, I don't even know why I'm telling you this, but you ask, and you might be seeing a lot of Nurse Mentone, so maybe it wouldn't hurt you to understand something about her. All I know about her is that sometime quite a while back, I get the impression it might have been 20 or 30 years ago, she and her husband, and I think two children, were driving home across the Bay Bridge one night." "Oh no," I thought. "There were three children, two young ones and a newborn. I know this story. Don't make me listen to it." "Listen, that's okay. I shouldn't have been prying. It's really none of my business." "No, you ask." "Anyway, it was nighttime, like I said. Getting pretty late, and somebody, some drunk driver, drove up the wrong way onto the bridge and crashed head-on into their car. Everybody in her family was killed. From what I understand, only she and the drunk... From what I understand, only she and the drunk driving the other car walked away. And that was pretty much what happened. Except I can remember lying on the living room carpet reading. Tina in the other room, probably watching television, when my dad stiffened abruptly from his recliner out of his normal taciturnity, reached over and adjusted a dial on his police band radio and said, "Oh Lord, somebody's driving the wrong way on the Pensacola Bridge. They've just had someone call it in. He's already liked to run a couple of folks off the bridge." My mom, sitting at the kitchen table, closed the magazine she was looking at and said, "Oh no, oh please, Jesus, no, help them." My dad leaned over and shut his eyes, listening intently, then translated the dispassionate recitation of numbers and codes from the dry speaker into the news that the driver had collided with an oncoming car and every emergency vehicle from the city of Pensacola to Gulf Breeze was being immediately dispatched. The next morning, my mom read aloud the news journal's account of the mindlessly inebriated 27-year-old sailor who had celebrated the news of his impending fatherhood by indelibly wiping four lives off the evening slate and forever twisting one more into the permanent bitter posture of the deeply and forever maimed. "That's the story," she said finally. "Why don't you tell me why I'm seeing you today?" "Okay. You're seeing me today because I'm a drunk, and I sometimes get in trouble as a result of that fact. This would represent one of those times." "I see. Well, at least you're honest about it." "Disarmingly so. You'll find that I will be totally honest with you any time I can serve my own interest by doing so. Have you been drinking this morning?" "Yes. And you know I have, but thanks for asking anyway. However, I've only had one beer. And only because that was the absolute minimum I needed to get myself shaved and dressed and down here. Not a single drop for any recreational purposes, I can assure you. Okay, Paul. The heads up I got on you says this is your second DUI within the past 5 years. You blew over a .30 on this one, and they'll probably tack on reckless driving and resisting arrest. So, in addition to the time you've already served, it looks like you're definitely looking at some real jail time. That sound about right? Well, it sounds about accurate. About right would be somewhere between letting me go without further penalty in consideration of pain already served and beheading me in Seville Square in front of an audience of my unintended victims. She was watching me with quick, lively eyes, her pupils shining, her forehead unfurrowed. Well, well, an alcoholic who's both blameless and a martyr. How unusual. And my nose is running, so I actually... do you have a Kleenex by any chance? This is not a part of the story.
You're going to have to use your sleeve.
Okay, I'm going to have to use my sleeve. All right, okay. Let me get back to the story. All right, okay. Well, an alcoholic who's both blameless and a martyr. How unusual. That's like finding a dishonest drug addict, isn't it? Well, Paul, let me tell you what else sounds about accurate. You're making jokes about this because you don't want to face the fact that you could be put away behind bars for a year or more. You're sitting in my office right now under the influence of alcohol, I might add, because your life is completely unmanageable and you have no control over your drinking whatsoever. You're witty, illiterate, well-educated, and you're a dead-end drunk who's probably lost just about everything that has any real meaning in your life. And you're on your way to jail or prison or something much, much worse. How does that sound so far? Right on the money. I twisted my chair and longed for the days when offices of any sort came with ashtrays as standard bureaucratic issue. I'm very afraid of going to prison. I am under the influence of alcohol. I don't buy that my life is completely unmanageable, but it's close enough to it so that I'm not going to quibble with you. And the control I had this morning, when I sat down to drink only one beer and did just exactly that, that control is as likely to evaporate with the next sip I take as dew is on a hot summer's morning. Her small shoulders seemed almost to faint as she moved in for the kill. You're not a first-timer, Paul. You know what you have to do, don't you? You just have to not take the next sip. You have to quit. There. She packaged it neatly, and then the deft delivery. I know, I said, but I'm not going to. I don't think I can, and even if I could, I'm not going to. Paul, listen, you don't have any insurance, do you? No, of course not. Doesn't matter. We can get you into treatment somewhere. I'll find you a bed, I promise. You can quit, Paul. You can. I suppose I'll have to if they put me in county for a few months, or Rayford for a while, won't I? But that's then, that's tomorrow, and that's when I'll quit. Just like everybody else, just like every other good alcoholic in the world, that's when I'll do it. That's when I'll quit. Tomorrow. Tomorrow might be too late, but now she was just saying the words, the thrust of any argument gone, the fight having become an empty one, rote, against an unworthy opponent whose substance was smoke. She talked a little while longer, urged me to find employment, see my attorney, do at least one or two things that might make me appear redeemable in the eventual eyes of a court, then bade me goodbye and sent me out to the front desk to make a return appointment. As I stood before Delcy Mentone's grimy and pitiful station and watched her consult a calendar, fiercely scribbling a terse notation on a stiff card, I watched the top of her lacquered, redoubtable head and said, "Listen, ma'am, what I said to you a little while ago, that was terribly rude, and I'm sorry. I apologize." "Like that ever made anything all right," she said, and fired the card into my chest.
Ooh. Thank you. Have a slug.
You might want to explain that last comment, "have a slug."
No. He has a bottle of water, everybody. Just a bottle of water. Well, I'm Lorna Reese, and you're listening to Lopez Writers Read on KLOI 102.5 FM, and we're talking today with Steve Adams. Well, Steve, that's a really interesting character. I have noticed that in the three, I've heard this, and I've heard another piece of yours, and I've read one of your stories, and humor is quite a common element in all of the things. Is it in all of the things that you write, and do you do that consciously, or is that just, you coming through?
I guess it's present in most of the things I write, even things that are not particularly funny, as
right.
This scene is not particularly funny.
Mm-hmm.
At least I didn't intend it to be so, but
no.
There is humor in it, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be a person who laughs a lot, and the old saying, sooner or later everything's either forgotten or funny.
I've never heard that.
You have. And humor communicates, and I enjoy writing or attempting to write humor. It's very satisfying when I write something and someone is reading it, and something that I found funny, they too seem to respond to. The reading the other evening at the community center, it felt great to have people laughing at things that I thought were funny. So I would say it's not so much deliberate as it is just a part of my personality and my style.
Mm-hmm. So it is you coming through in the things that you write.
I think so. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I wondered too. Sif, you've written a whole novel about Paul. And how did you feel about him after you finished the book? I mean, did Paul go away, or do you still think about him, or what happens to characters when you finish a story or a book?
You know, generally the characters generally when I'm through with the story and I'm through with the revisions, I'm through with it. I mean, I just don't look back at it. I do have characters that I can see, and I've actually had characters who have recurred in other works because they have certain unforgettable traits.
As secondary characters or something?
As secondary characters.
Mm-hmm.
As they might just drive by, for
uh-huh.
heaven's sakes. They might just
yes.
be the passenger in a car. It's interesting, I'll say this about Yennestra. I was 200 pages into it when suddenly I realized that, I mean, I had no idea how it was going to end, I have to say. That's not true. I thought I knew how it was going to end. But I was about 200 pages into it when it occurred to me that I was about to solve a really great mystery as to what happened to an important Southern icon, and so the novel does address that, and beyond that I'll just leave it there, and I had no idea that was going to happen. It wasn't until, as I said, a couple of hundred pages into it. I don't revisit Paul. I do revisit a lot of the material, because a lot of the material has to do with where I grew up and the people with whom I grew up, and of course that is what we all revisit, you know, in our lives.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I asked that question is that I've noticed with some writers now that they do will write linked short stories about characters. Amy Bloom, I think, does that. And I don't know if you've heard of Elizabeth Strout. She wrote a book called Olive Kittredge.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally loved Olive Kittredge.
And Alice Munro's
Oh, yes.
View from Castle Rock.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it goes back to, I think, of something like Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio,
which was
mm-hmm. I read as a boy and was so influenced by I love the idea of the short story sequence, and I've never done that, but I now that you bring it up, I ask myself why not?
Because
it's incredible.
Yeah, and you have such delightful characters. I can imagine them all kind of interacting or in some way in mm-hmm. the same small town or whatever. There's also Marilynne Robinson's books, Gilead and Home, same story told from two totally different viewpoints.
Oh, I know.
Amazing.
Talking of regionalism, I had never heard of Home. I'd never heard of Marilynne Robinson until I came out here, and Elizabeth Simpson at the school gave me a copy of Home. And
no, Housekeeping.
Oh,
she gave you Housekeeping because she gave it to me too.
Oh, is that
that's
was
the first
her,
one?
First, okay,
two
good. Thank you. Yeah. That is the one she gave me, and you're correct. Thank you very much because it's been a number of years,
Now the Men of Gilead a couple years ago,
right?
And then now Home.
And I have not read Home. I've read Gilead, but
I've
I have
got it
not
in the car.
Home.
I'll give it to you.
No, I can't. I can't take another book from another person right now. But I will put it on my list. I promise you.
Okay.
Elizabeth introduced me to. She took my overly biased Southern reading habits and said, in effect, boy, I'm going to bring you into the Northwest. And she did a wonderful job of doing so.
Oh, good. Well, now, the story that you just read to us, or the portion of that novel, was written in the first person. The other pieces that I've heard from you are the two have been in third person, I believe. Mm-hmm. How do you choose? I mean, is that also an unconscious or instinctive thing, or do you stop and think about, what you're trying to do?
That's a good question. I would say with Yenestra, it was I knew it had to be first person
because
it was in order to see things, to describe things the way I wanted them described, in order to see things the way I wanted them seen, I had to see them through Paul's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
The story I read the other evening, Better to Go Down Dignified, was originally written in the first person, and I wasn't satisfied with that, so I used that third person with sort of the limited omniscient point of view. It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. It's just most of the time I'm a page into the story before I know what in the world it is that I'm really doing, except mm-hmm. I'm just dealing with that event or that moment or that voice. And then if it doesn't feel right, I will go back and I'll, as I said with that story, I went back and I totally changed the point of view and was much more satisfied with it. So.
Okay. Yeah, I'm always interested in why things are told from a certain story perspective. And I don't, when I'm writing something, I don't consciously think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes out some way.
Yeah.
So I always am looking to see if other people have the same experience.
Yeah, well, it's, it is so, that is such an interesting question. I mean, I think of one of my favorite books of all time, which is The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow. And I cannot imagine that book being told in any way other than Augie's voice. A voice that is every bit as resoundingly originally American as that of Huckleberry Finn's. That's a really good thing to explore.
Well, another thing I wanted to ask you refers back to the story. What you just read to us, you said you knew how that book was going to end, although it changed a little. So I'm wondering, when you start a story or a novel or a grocery list, do you know how it's going to end, or do you kind of start off and just sort of go along for the ride?
Yeah, I would say maybe 50-50, and out of the 50% of the time when I know how it's going to end, about half of that time, it doesn't really end up ending that way.
That's right.
I wrote a novel which was actually it was an exercise. I wanted to see if I could write a novel in 30 days, and wanted to write a mystery.
Yeah,
and so I knew I needed to actually do something I normally don't do, which is to kind of plot it all out, and including the ending. And there were still some surprises along the way for me, which is, you know, always the delight of writing. And so, you know, I would say about half the time I do think I know the ending. The other half, I couldn't tell you. It's just, let's see, you know, let's get in this car and see where we run out of gas, you know, or hit a tree or, you know, spend the night or whatever.
I think this would be a good time for us to hear something else from you.
Okay. So. Well, this is the piece I alluded to earlier, which was based on having seen, and most of us have seen those in a, in some sort of child's, you know, amusement arcade.
Like IKEA, IKEA, they have something
That. That kind of thing. I've been to IKEA twice, and I'm really trying to put that out of my mind. So, but anyway, this is a, it's a fairly long story for me. I think it's around 9,000 words.
Ooh, that is.
And I have rewritten it. I cannot tell you how many times I've rewritten it. I have sent it out numerous times, and the only time I received a handwritten reply to it, the individual who wrote it liked the story, and it obviously read the story, but they wanted a kind of resolution in the story which I felt would, you know, and it's not like I have a lot of, you know, moral issues about my writing, but I, it was something I could not do with this particular story. So this is a story, I'm reading the opening page and a half from a story called Uncle Zubies, and I will try not to, you know, sniffle or, you know, while I'm doing this.
Whatever, be comfortable.
Whatever, okay. I'll take my shoes off then. Okay, anyway, this is the latest draft of a story that I first wrote 5 years ago in a totally different incarnation called Uncle Zubies. Is there anyone left among us who has not seen the now famous videotape? Do you need a reminder? Then close your eyes and let us help you begin to picture it. Rectangular, the size of a freestanding backyard pool, filled not with water, but a midden of apple-sized plastic balls. Unnatural in color, the neon hue of popsicles. See how it resides between the super squirter and the whack-a-mole. Here, the chubby toddler makes his first taped appearance. Can you now see him? Round and heavy enough to cause his young mother to gasp and strain when she lifts him. More than one person, upon watching the surveillance tape, will comment that both his morphology and pallor remind them of an enormous frozen turkey. But, in the beginning, those observations will be rendered sotto voce, out of deference for the circumstances. Watch as she nestles him within the enclosure among five other children, all older, who are listlessly working their way in meandering swaths, the balls clacking and rustling. After depositing him, can you see her taking a step back, her feet nudging a loose, rolling, errant ball? Bending down and scooping it up, she now rears her arm, stiffly, prepared to toss it back into the ball bath, then stopping. Perhaps she sees the sign. Persons caught throwing these balls will be maybe asked to leave. The same sign hanging directly underneath one ordaining that unattended children are not to be allowed by adults. There's even one over the door assuring patrons that Uncle Zubies wants you to enjoy your fun, so be careful, you. Which is so linguistically mangled as to become briefly famous when David Letterman glibly suggests that it sounds as if the former president of the United States might be moonlighting as a copywriter for an amusement arcade in Northwest Florida. For a moment, she watches the child as he twists his head and shoulders to look back at his mother. But the quality of the tape poor and the angle wrong, we can only imagine the glint of raw terror that may have winked like heat lightning through his eyes. What she does next, of course, is to become the focus of much of the debate and outrage that will follow. After reassuring herself of his shuffling location in the shifting pool of plastic balls which fills the ball bath, she turns her back on her son and walks over to a soda machine against the far wall, where she purchases a 20-ounce Diet Pepsi. Scholars of the event later document the price at an extortionary $3. Had she looked back even one time with the most cursory of glances as she was walking away, she may well have seen her child's tiny hand, forlorn and solitary, slipping beneath the rounded and rolling surface of the balls, curled lightly open as if caught forever in the act of waving, a final goodbye.
You're just going to leave us with that?
Well, I mean, but I'll be happy to read the whole thing if somebody will offer me, you know. So, yes, I am going to leave you with that.
That is amazing. So that's certainly the kind of story that you couldn't have known what was going to happen. I mean, when you started writing it, was it to discover?
It was very much to discover. It was to speculate on, as I said, just that bizarre question. Mm-hmm. What would happen? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if it was. I mean, I don't write science fiction. I don't even read a whole lot of it, although I've certainly read some good sci-fi. I thought it may become a sci-fi story. Indeed, it ended up becoming a lot more of a story of social commentary, I think, than anything else. And I was very surprised by the scope it took. Mm-hmm.
And 9,000 words is a long short story.
Yeah, it really is, yeah. Which makes it almost impossible to sell, too, I'll tell you.
It's more like a novella, isn't it?
Yeah. Anything over about my experience of getting lots and lots of rejection letters is that anything over about 4,500, 5,000 words is just going to be very difficult to peddle.
I've started to notice that myself, so mm-hmm. It's unfortunate, because when you're writing a story, you don't think about, you know, keeping it under a certain word limit. You just have to tell the story.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, well, I was interested, too, in how many drafts. I mean, is it... long ago, the first writing teacher I ever had said that she wrote 25 to 30 drafts of a short story. I thought, oh, my God. So I have some pieces I've written 15, 16 drafts.
Right.
But maybe that's why they don't get published, is because they're not 25 to 30 drafts. But do you have any sense of how much revision you do?
I can tell you for individual pieces. Mm-hmm. For example, Uncle Zuby's, I probably wrote 10 or 12 drafts and then put it aside for a couple of years.
Yep,
and
that's reasonable.
And then pulled it out and completely rewrote the beginning a half a dozen times easily. And since I pulled it out because I knew that I really wanted to share at least part of it during this interview, I started, you know,
rewriting again.
So I will say this: I find that the short stories are easier for me to revise because I can kind of see them all at once.
Mm-hmm, right.
Revising a novel is, as a matter of fact, I went to one of Kieran Fisher's wonderful workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And for anyone who has never been to one and who has any interest in writing at all, you're cheating yourself. If she's giving a workshop anywhere, you need to to avail yourself of that opportunity. But I talked to her about the difficulty of it, and she gave me the most worthless piece of advice I could possibly imagine getting, which is, well, Steve, it's just really hard to revise a novel, you know. And I wanted a magic clue, but yeah. I know Yenestra, I have rewritten, I would say 6 times, and it needs a lot more work.
Well, I'd like to ask you more about that, but I see that we're running out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. I want to say thank you.
And I thank you.
And listeners can read some of Steve's work on Shark Reef, the literary magazine of the Lopez Writers Guild. There's plenty of other fine writing by Lopez writers at Shark Reef as well, so just go to sharkreef.org. And I want to let you know that this interview with Steve will be archived to KLOI's website after it airs. So if you miss any part of it, you're driving in your car and get to your destination so you don't hear it all, well, you can hear it all again at your own convenience by going to kloi.org and clicking on Archives. Interviews already there include talks with Iris Gravel, Julie Van Camp, Kip Greenthal, Allie Smalders, and Molly Swan Sheeran. You've been listening to Lopez Writers Read on KLOI FM 102.9. This program is being pre-recorded. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, write on.